I figured you'd go through this.
Oh, yeah.
Together.
Good afternoon, everyone. We're so pleased to have you with us. Today is February 14th, our state's birthday, as well as Valentine's Day. And this is the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. Our purpose today is to hold a public hearing, I believe for the next 2 days, on the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. So I'm going to go ahead and convene our public hearing. Now, as is our practice, when we get new budgets, we often get new budget analysts who are here with us. So I'm going to invite today's analyst to both introduce herself and today's topics.
All right. Thank you, Chair Gomberg. Members of the subcommittee, I'm Amanda Beidle. With the Legislative Fiscal Office. And as the Chair noted, House Bill 5039 is the budget bill for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. The materials for today's meeting are posted under today's date on OLIS. And as a brief introduction, the budget for the department is comprised of about three primary program areas that are supported by the agency's operations. The Veterans Loan Program is funded entirely with other funds, provides home loans to veterans, and the other funds are generated through the sale of bonds, loan repayments, investment earnings. The Veterans Home Program operates two skilled and memory care facilities in skilled nursing and memory care facilities in the Dalles and Lebanon. The operating costs of those facilities are funded entirely with other funds from resident-related income. And the Veterans Services Program provides claims and appeals assistance, aging veteran services such as conservatorship services, partnerships with counties and national service organizations. And historically, the Veterans Services Program has been funded with general fund and other funds from conservatorship fees and home loan program revenues. However, with the passage of Measure 96, lottery funds are now available for veteran services. So the department's budget includes policy option packages investing those lottery funds into veteran services programs. The total 2017-19 current service level budget for the department is $485.4 million, including 88 FTE. However, I will note 80% of that budget is attributable to non-limited other funds in the home loan program. And as I just mentioned, since the lottery revenue is added through policy option packages, that current service level budget does not include those revenues, which based on the December 2016 forecast are estimated to be $18.5 million. So with that, I will hand it back over to start the agency presentation.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for that overview. But before we do that, before I call on Director Smith, I saw Senator Boquist is with us today. And out of respect for his busy schedule, because I know we all have busy schedules, I was going to invite him to come in and share a few observations with us. Welcome, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Co-Chair, who I see is out transportationing things, distinguished senators and representatives. For the record, I am State Senator Brian Boquist. I chair the Veterans and Emergency Preparedness Committee in the Senate. And today I'm speaking slightly out of turn, but with the approval of the chairman of the House Veterans Committee, too. I've sent an email to staff. She probably hasn't seen it. It would become part of the public record. And once again, I will have open mouth, inserted foot, and probably irritated the executive branch, but since we're the legislative branch, Senator Monroe, you know I do not care. Okay. Veterans like to speak with one word. I think the public outlined in the passage of the veterans ballot measure at 83%, the highest on record, I think, in the state of Oregon. I think the message kind of came out loud and clear. Unfortunately, I cannot say that all veterans speak with the same language at this particular point in time, and so I would like to put on the record that the two chairs of the respective committees are opposed to the governor's budget as presented. Big surprise, right? I think most of you know how the governor's budget comes in. I would also like to tell you that at a future point, the two policy committees will come back with our comments and recommendations on your policy option packages and some of the corrections that could be done. I would point out that the agency itself has gone through some transformation. It's doing a good job. It does a good things for veterans. Some of us have been involved in helping that. The new director is going to come forth and present the veterans case from the governor's perspective. I would wager that if I bent his arm as a good Marine major, he would actually say something slightly different, but he's going to be a good follower as the director and present you the governor's budget, which the two chairs are in opposition to at this particular point in time. So please don't take it out on him, and we will be back, unfortunately, a little farther in the session with some recommendations on the policy option packages and some better investments that actually not only help veterans, but if you go across the board into other arenas, can help and improve health care in the state, help offset other budget that we have through the wise investment of some of these funds. And no, we're not asking for all of the lottery money, Madam Chair and Madam and Mr. Chair. We're only saying the way she's presented it, we don't agree with. I'd be happy to entertain questions, but I'm quite sure as budgeteers you could go after the agency without my help.
Any questions? Yes, Senator Johnson.
I have one. Given your intimate knowledge of these issues, it's been my experience already that the little Pac-Men have already started coming out. Everybody wants a piece of that veterans money. I know that you just told us that you're going to come back with recommendations, but do you have one that seems to soar above the rest? And that's a loaded question because my bias has been, with help of the co-chair of this committee, in trying to funnel more money to the CVSOs, general fund, in previous sessions. But do you have a thought about how you're going to impose adequate discipline for all these little nibbles?
Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, I think I would agree with you on the last three letters of your acronym. I think, you know, we've traditionally gone after county veteran service officers as the low-hanging fruit. We have netted about $1.1 billion in the 8 years we've been at those for those members have been here. Almost, I think, correct me, Mr. Director, about 600 of that has been, frankly, offset to other programs we would have had in the health and human services areas. And so for, you know, basically a $1 to $200 ratio, we've been able to approach it, approach a mechanism in which we can receive federal funds for veterans and then utilize the funds that we would have got in state matching dollars elsewhere. So I'm fully on board, and I think the low-hanging fruit remains the veteran service officers. The question is, I think some of you may recall, we went out and hired a couple special ones to raid senior centers at one point, and actually that was a very productive operation where we sent VSOs out to senior centers and we got more people enrolled.
We use cultivate instead of raid.
Madam, that's your problem. That's your problem. I'm trying to up you one since I'm on transportation with you and, you know, and be the most politically incorrect person in the room. And I'll do that as long as I'm speaking out for veterans. But I think the VSO is the right direction to go. I think there's other, you're going to hear some proposals in the policy option packages that are out there that actually are a variant of the VSO, you could say, that are more outreach. You just need to remember that we're leaving about $3 to $4 billion of unclaimed veterans benefits on the table right now. And that amount of money could be utilized to offset other programs so veterans could serve twice. And that's the goal here. Chairman Evans and the two policy committees, and of course, when those recommendations come, they will come bipartisan, and they will come with the majority of the vote from the two respective policy committees.
Follow-up question?
The Colonel presents an intriguing target of opportunity, so I want to ask you one other one. In your military as well as your legislative estimation, how is the Veterans Services on Lines for Life performing?
Clarification, Madam Co-Chair, are you talking about the lines of life in terms of the suicide
prevention? The suicide prevention, and I should have been more precise.
Right.
The one that's staffed by veterans, utilized by veterans, right. And I just wonder if, in your estimation, it's proving efficacious.
It has proven to be about the only access and avenue we have to that particular type of service. The Federal Veterans Administration has, in fact, stepped up and put a little bit of funding into that category. But in terms of the suicide prevention, that has been about the only successful one we have. I think, you know, we tried another program and it did not work out. I've not seen a pop or anything along that lines in terms of the present funding level, but that type of program is really what keeps them out of the law enforcement arena. It keeps them out of the public health arena, and it keeps them from shooting themselves.
One more follow-up, please. Would you deem it appropriate to have any of that lottery ballot measure money put towards Lines for Life? Because I share your opinion that that has been a very good service, particularly because it's peers answering the telephone. I don't mean peers by rank, but people who have served our country.
Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, we have traditionally in the past had to go in and, I don't want to say bail out, but prop up that program because our Federalist friends have not done that. When there is a hole in that deal, I think it would be appropriate for this fund. And in fact, since we're generating somewhere in the neighborhood of a couple hundred million dollars a year, each year in new offsetting funds, an investment of $1 million, just hypothetically, I'm not saying anything, hypothetically in a fund like that, more than pays for itself.
Thank
you. In fact, it's about a 99-to-1 match.
Thank you.
And Mr. Kocher, get it.
Any other questions for the senator? Senator, thank you so much. And I note that you are not the only veteran in the room today. We thank all of you for your service to our state and to our country. And I'm going to invite Director Smith to come up. And Madam Co-Chair, I wanted to indicate that today we are scheduled only for an agency presentation. Tomorrow is scheduled for public testimony. I see some guests with us today. If there's someone who has traveled a long distance and is not able to be with us tomorrow but wanted the opportunity to share some observations with the committee, if they could let committee staff know that, and we will try and accommodate you. But tomorrow is the main day scheduled for public testimony.
Thank you for that reminder. I just didn't know if the Colonel was going to be joining us again.
Well, he was here. We know what the legislative schedules are like. We slotted him right away.
Cool.
Director Smith, welcome.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Cameron Smith. And first and foremost, I'm a proud Marine, served 3 tours in Iraq, and now have the privilege and honor to be the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And it's a real honor to be able to present today before all of you both the story of our veterans community and the landscape of what our veterans community looks like today, the efforts that we are doing as a team and with partners, and where we are headed as a department. But I do not envy your task this session. It is a difficult budget with difficult choices. And I think often we become too fixated on a number. And whatever the resources that are entrusted to us to better serve veterans and their families, we look forward to delivering on that mission and that commitment. Your questions make us better. Feel free to interrupt during the presentation, and we'll certainly leave time at the end as well. With that, any success we have as a department is because of who we serve, our Oregon veterans and their families. It is an incredible population of our citizens, and we are a diverse but united group. We are men and women. We are young and old. We are urban and rural. We are every ethnicity and every religion. We are Oregon veterans. The only thing that divides us is which branch in the military did we serve in. And we have two new members of this committee that did serve, Representative Reardon, a proud Navy officer in Vietnam era, submariner in the Navy, and then Representative Meek, a proud Air Force veteran. And I'm astonished that they said before this hearing began that they believed Marine stands for muscles are required, intelligence not essential. So I just can't believe they would put that on the record formally. So our vision at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs is that veterans and their families thrive in Oregon. And we stood up in 1945, in that final year of World War II, more than 70 years ago. And our mission, that we serve and honor veterans through our leadership, our advocacy, and our strong partnerships. And when we talk about our leadership, that's a lot of our core programs that you'll hear today presented in their results for veterans. But it is also about that advocacy and strong partnerships. We care ultimately more about the outcomes and the results for the veterans and their families than whether it's directly provided by us. And to get those outcomes for that cross generation of veterans, for their health, their education, and their economic opportunity. And we do have 4 generations of veterans across 5 major wars, from World War II to today. And here is one of our greatest generation, Jean Wojnowski. She was an Army nurse during World War II. And many of the nurses served stateside, but she ended up going over to the South Pacific, serving in the jungles of Papua New Guinea. Ended up meeting her brother, who was serving as a Marine, in one of the hospitals over there, coincidentally, and was one of our keynote speakers at the Veterans Day event this last year, and will be 102 this May. And not many of her fellow Greatest Generation left, about 5% of our veterans population. This is Stephen Wright, a Korean War era veteran, so not far behind that World War II generation, but often a forgotten war and a forgotten generation of veterans. Stephen was an Air Force veteran. His mother had to sign his paperwork when he was just 17. The next day, he was going to boot camp and serving in the Air Force.
And this is Milton Leroy Bartlett. He's a Vietnam-era veteran, served in the Army with armored personnel carriers, and is also a member of that Vietnam generation, which is the largest segment of our veterans population at almost 36% of our veterans. And many of the folks here today served in Vietnam and truly are the leaders of our veterans community. You'll also notice his native veteran hat. So our tribal veterans, despite a long and challenging history with the federal government and our tribal nations, our tribal veterans have served at a higher level per capita than almost any other group. And while 75% of our veterans served during a wartime conflict era, about a quarter served during peacetime. And Cheryl Ann Carlton here, an Army veteran and a member of that fastest rising demographic of veterans, are women veterans. Women veterans make up about 9% of our veterans population today, and about 15% active duty today. So it's going to be one of the fastest rising over the next 20, 30 years. And then our final generation of Gulf War I, back to the early 90s, and then to the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. This is Jimmy Lee, both an Army and an Air Force veteran, current member of the Oregon National Guard, served in Iraq, and went back using the GI Bill to go back to culinary school. But really that common bond across the eras and across a very diverse veterans community. So overall, Oregon veterans make up 1 out of every 12 Oregonians, and we have 326,000 veterans across the state. About 22% of our veterans have a service-connected disability, so that's about 22%, but we estimate about 3 out of every 10 Oregon veterans access what are largely their federal VA benefits. Many folks use that GI Bill coming back to go back to school. Some use a VA home loan or one of ours. But in terms of that ongoing health care access and disability compensation, it is about a third of our veterans.
Mr. Chair. Senator Johnson.
Mr. Director, have you done any analysis other than anecdotal about the small number of people accessing benefits that they were promised and they earned? Is it the bureaucracy that makes it too out of reach? Is it distance? Is it the lack of transportation? Why so few? Because it would seem to me that everybody that's put on a uniform of this country knows that there are benefits available with. Why so few people take advantage?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, a complicated question, but I think ultimately goes to our strategic plan and our strategic work. But there's a cultural reason, whether you look at Vietnam veterans not being welcomed home in their own time, now finally engaging 40, 50 years after their service. We do have a significant aging veterans population, often not raising their hand for those benefits. Sometimes women veterans don't identify as veterans. The rural nature, when you look at where I grew up in Massachusetts, you know, there's 4 VA hospitals across 4 hours. The distances that often veterans have to travel for the VA benefits, and simply that warrior ethos that when we are wearing the uniform, we often don't raise our hand for a sprained ankle, much less a mental health challenge, making sure, and it is a complicated bureaucratic system, having that advocate in your corner goes a long way.
A follow-up?
Please.
I think one of the most innovative things that you've done during your tenure as director is to institute the, for lack of a better word, senior veterans ombudsperson, and you have an extraordinarily capable woman filling that role. Could you comment on how productive that function is in reaching out to some of these aging veterans with a unique set of health and sometimes concomitant economic problems?
So, co-chairs, members of the committee, we poached Mary Yeager away from the long-term care ombudsman office
And she is a whirling dervish of all things aging, and has brought expertise both to our two skilled nursing facilities, our conservatorship program, but also those broader partnerships, linking us not only across state agencies, but also public and private partners. We were measuring the steps between ODVA and DHS door to door, only 222 paces by my steps, but rarely were those two worlds linking. So Veteran Services is human services. It is about healthcare. It is about mental health. It is about accessing those benefits. So beyond just our core programs, she is helping link us to better take advantage of these different systems. So this morning I was with the Agency
on Aging.
For all of the acronyms that the military veterans community has, it is equally so on the aging and human services side. And we are not trying to recreate programs at ODVA, but create links and bridges across them, whether it's an aging population, whether student veterans, whether on housing, because there are tremendous resources to draw down from the federal VA that currently not just bring those tax dollars home, but also save on general funded services where veterans are falling on different parts of either state or local government systems.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. And Director Smith, I wanted to zero in on these two statistics you've got on the current slide, the service disabilities and 3 out of 10 penetration into our veterans community. Are we doing a better job than 3 out of 10 in reaching out to those people who have recognized disabilities?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, so every one of those service-connected veterans has submitted a claim back through the federal VA, and the vast majority of those are going to flow through those county veteran service offices, ODVA, or those national service organizations. When we take on that power of attorney and submit a claim, we are also looking not just at what benefits at the federal VA side, but also those community benefits. So those folks are getting significant resources and have been pulled into our system. But from some future slides, you'll see we're still skimming the surface of the opportunity of outreach and connecting to more Oregon veterans.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions?
Chair.
Please.
Thank you, Chair. Just a quick question. With all the PTSD ramifications, how is the Department of Veterans Affairs either dealing with that? Do you have, I've dealt with and met with some veterans that feel discriminated against, that their doctors are saying that they have PTSD, and then the veterans are rejecting their claims. And so I just, you know, what is the policy for the Veterans Department to deal with those? Because I think it's, you know, both the younger and the older generations right now are dealing and dire, you know, needs for some treatment and help and counseling.
So co-chairs, representative, members of the committee, post-traumatic stress and traumatic brain injury are those signature injuries of the Iraq and Afghanistan war. Invisible injuries, which are hard, just like we have the challenge of making sure mental health is viewed as physical health, have that same challenge for the veterans population. But while we're 1 out of every 12 Oregonians, we're a quarter of all suicides in this state, which is largely driven from that mental health care side. There's been significant, both on the disability side and rating those claims. It's a more difficult claim to submit than a physical injury, but the VA has recognized that it is an injury. And more are approving those. And this is something that has, you know, the Vietnam generation took a lot longer to finally get there, whether on Agent Orange or mental health issues. And then on the healthcare side, it is still a challenge to get access to mental health care, especially in rural Oregon, to make sure we do have those providers. So our largest play in that is leveraging that federal VA system for Oregon veterans. And as was also mentioned, we've been a pass-through on about $350,000 to a suicide crisis line. That's specifically for military and veterans. So when veterans are in crisis, that it is someone who can understand the lingo and know what a military occupational specialty MOS is, that might be familiar with weapons that our veterans might have, and feels comfortable talking to them, and then linking them whether to a VSO for further benefits or other mental health resources.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you.
All right. Please continue.
I'm regretting my opening the questions not until the end. So off of, while only 3 out of every Oregon 10 veterans access those benefits, it is a significant economic infusion, both for those veterans and their families to thrive, but also to our state. So this is federal VA disability compensation and low-income pensions. In this last calendar year for 2015, now drawing down $1.3 billion, and this is cash that is flowing into the bank accounts and wallets of Oregon veterans. It doesn't look like much of an increase since 2013, but that's $1.1 to $1.3 billion, an extra $200 million now coming back to Oregon veterans. And when you compare it to the start of that Iraq-Afghanistan conflict, it's almost tripled in terms of the disability compensation and resources. Works out to be over $100 million per month in disability compensation and low-income pensions. And on average, each service-connected veteran with a disability receives about $15,000. 100% disabled veteran would go up to about $36,000, but on average, $15,000 per service-connected disabled veteran.
Mr. Chair.
Please, Senator Johnson.
I hadn't thought about this until right this second. Let's assume that there is benefits. There are benefits discovered by the intervention of a county veteran service officer. Does that money come lump sum to the veteran, or is it in some kind of health account? The point that I'm getting to is, and you had mentioned your conservatorship functions when you first started speaking, is there any effort to help, say, aging vets with financial literacy or the ability to maximize those benefit awards if there is a cash element?
So, co-chairs, members of the committee, in terms of you get a date of submission from your claim. Sometimes in the delay that it takes the federal VA to rate that decision, they will go back to that original date. So that first check after award may be a sizable and significant retroactive payment. From there on, it's on an ongoing basis. And both across federal VA benefits and Social Security benefits, when veterans are not, so we don't have a financial literacy program to speak of other than where we can make those links to the public and private sector. But our representative payee program that has started out of Hyde, and you'll hear a pitch later today, representative payee is essentially for those veterans that aren't able to manage their finances. It's almost like a bill-paying service where together the federal VA or Social Security and the veteran and their family lay out what their budget is and then have the representative payee pay on behalf of the veteran for their services.
Follow up.
Please.
I hate to add the specter of something that might be sinister, but it concerns me if you had an elderly veteran in receipt of a substantial cash payment for the potential of fraud or abuse or just with pent-up need, profligate spending that doesn't cause the money to endure for future needs.
And co-chairs, members of the committee, a lot of scams out there. I mean, this is veteran service officers are a free service from the county and state. Often you see scams out there helping veterans access their benefits, or then on the back end, some financial scams. And that's where we try to work better across elder abuse, across Department of Justice, some of the consumer protection, AARP, and other partners to make sure that veterans and their families aren't being scammed.
Representative.
Thank you, Chair. So the $15,225, and Cameron, I'm sorry, I'm just new to this. So is there a policy that, you know, kind of around that number that indicates, you know, are we supposed to be paying for their rent or just buying them a hamburger every month or whatever? Because that looks like a really small amount to me. So
co-chairs, Representative Reardon, that's the average annual payment, but that actually goes, that is the veteran's disability payment. So it goes directly into their bank account and wallet for their services, depending on the level of their service-connected injury. So no mandate how they then use those funds.
Follow up,
please.
No, I'm asking if there was a federal policy in their wisdom. Did the feds decide that this is an adequate amount for somebody to live on, if they want to live on the street or if they want to live in a home or how that number was derived? Any idea?
Co-chairs, Representative Reeder, that's a, I don't know if I have the best answer for that. In terms of when you get up to that fully 100% disabled and an unemployable scale, it is supposed to replace the income that would have been lost from that service-connected injury. But I don't know if there's a, how the rationale originally in terms of what 10%, 50%, 100%, and then how much that gets you. I'd have to dig in a little more.
Okay, and just one last place. And so this is just, I get that it's an average, so do you know the high and low money?
So co-chairs, Representative Reardon, it would be about $36,000 on an annual basis for 100% service-connected veteran.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And often, 100% service-connected may still be able to work and charge the Hill as a civilian in their civilian career, but it is compensation for that injury sustained during their service.
Okay, thank you.
So that $1.3 billion is a significant sum, but annually $2.6 billion are spent by the federal VA in Oregon. So beyond that disability payment, it's about $1 billion, $1 billion of health care, both at those major medical centers and now also the clinics for the federal VA spread out around the state. And what is a small slice is that $145 million. Of GI Bill, education, and voc rehab resources. But astounding, when we are putting together our budget, you know, $20 billion plus for general fund and lottery fund for the state of Oregon, almost over $5 billion from the federal VA is being spent. How do we better coordinate that and leverage those dollars to the Oregon way? So while we are proud, we have literally had that county VSO and statewide veteran services network since 1945 in partnership with the counties. We're proud of that advocacy and getting that compensation for disabled veterans. We, again, it's 72,000 service-connected disabled veterans out of our 326, but we know we are leaving resources on the table. So we compare roughly the same amount of veterans population between Oregon and Oklahoma for our veterans, but they've gone out and found and service-connected about 20,000, a little under 20,000 more of their veterans. Now, at this level, 326,000, 335,000, Oklahoma is not more, their population is not more disabled than Oregon's population. But they do have some structural advantages, larger active duty military bases. They do have more 20-plus year career retirees transitioning there. They also are a younger population. But we know, and just reaching that many more veterans, whether our younger just returning or those Vietnam veterans and older veterans, it's drawing down $500 million more per year for those veterans. So we know we are leaving, when Senator Boquist rattles off $3 or $4 billion, just on service-connected disability payments, we know we're leaving about $500 million to $1 billion a biennium on the table. So that's a huge opportunity for us to go get and to further draw down. And while we are fierce advocates for our VSOs, we have never seen a better return on investment for a state program. So at the local or state level, about $78,000 to pay for a veteran service officer, both for pay and benefits. In that first year, once they're trained, certified, and helping submit those claims, we've made significant investments over the multi-biennium that Senator Johnson was talking about. We can see the difference that those new VSOs in their first year drawing down $1.7 million. That's an ongoing annual, it rolls up. So when you have the five-year estimated cost for VSO, for less than half a million, they are making a 27-plus million impact of those dollars flowing back into their community.
Senator Johnson.
This is something that you and I, Mr. Director, have talked about offline, and I just have not circled back around to see if it's corrected, but I'm curious if all the CVSOs are treated the same. For example, I was made aware in one of the counties in my district that the way the pay happened, the CVSO was expected to kind of front-end load some of his own expenses, and then it was more a reimbursement kind of program. And I know that the counties participate, and in some cases not-for-profits participate, but do you have a reasonable belief that the CVSOs performing ostensibly the same functions are treated the same across the horizon?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I would say yes. I think in that particular circumstance, it was when the county was contracting with the Community Action Network, and it had kind of a unique arrangement. We do reimburse on a quarterly basis. So the state funds that we pass through to the county VSOs, it will be after they have expended it. So often it is front-loaded from the county's perspective and then reimbursed with those state dollars.
Okay. I just wonder, Philip, if we're putting any of our CVSOs, who, in my experience, are the most passionate, committed folks you'll ever run into, whether or not we put them at any disadvantage by not making sure that they've got a way to be paid themselves, but also for those emergencies where they are uniquely on the front lines, do they have any money that might get a vet through a food crisis, or are they relying on their partnerships with, like, the local community action teams and stuff like that? I just don't know whether or not you're involved with how they run their offices enough to give them a little bit of flexible money at their end, using their best judgment to help in a real crisis where there is no time for any bureaucracy.
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, I think part of this comes down to that commitment to the mission of all of these VSOs. They are going above and beyond for their veterans and military families. So I don't know if it's on the office expenses as much as those wraparound and emergency or emergent needs. Yes, they can get the veteran into disability compensation, but that takes time, and there may be an immediate housing need, or there may be an immediate food need or electricity bill. We have had about $100,000 on a biennial basis of an emergency assistance fund. It goes quickly, and we allot it quarterly. It still skims the surface of the opportunity that we see out there. Longer term, I mean, when we look at the support and the sea of goodwill that exists out there for veterans and military families, we've never truly capitalized on that opportunity in terms of fundraising at a broader level on a holistic basis. Again, there are a lot of mom-and-pop scam charities out there. Often we rely on the service organizations, but there is an opportunity to have a broader endowment over time to meet the what are very real needs, but can burn up budgets very quickly.
One last comment,
please.
Mr. Chair. I know from my episodic engagement with veterans in the district and programs being done for them that, as you characterized it, the reservoir of goodwill is enormous, and retailers are willing to make equipment and clothes and comestibles available for legitimate veterans affairs. And I would agree with you that there's probably an untapped opportunity to build up a support system that would have some statewide or countywide equity and the ability to respond very nimbly to emergencies.
And co-chairs, members of the committee, not unlike we've seen library foundations or parks foundations or the U of O and OSU foundations, that is the opportunity for an Oregon Veterans Community Foundation longer term. Had we done that in 1945, we would be sitting on a robust endowment beyond what the state and local governments can support as well.
I happen to know a great Marine that I can picture as the president of such a foundation quite easily, a Marine that used to have an office in this building. Not too far above where we're sitting.
Yes. Any other questions? We're going to dive into our core work for our Oregon veterans. So here is our strategic plan at a very high level. We are trying to target veteran services to serve more veterans and serve them better. This is everything that we're doing with the county and state veteran service officers. Going around, I was thinking of all of the different county commissioners in each of your communities that we're linking with. It is both investments out of the state level and the county level, and the real distinct roles that we're bringing with those county VSOs, the boots on the ground, and that statewide training, certification, the appellate work, and the review of claims coming up. Knowing that it's not just the counties and state, but how do we mobilize broader partnerships from the broad public and private sector and all levels of government that are serving veterans? Not necessarily a lack of awareness, but not necessarily a lack of resources for veterans that are out there, but often a lack of awareness of those resources and how do you connect to those resources, and ultimately how do we invigorate our core operations for those programs that are a direct responsibility, our home loan program, our two skilled nursing facilities, conservatorship, and other programs, making sure that we're bringing the best to bear across those. And I will not read through all of the strategies, but these are truly helping shape our work across the partnerships. Again, we talked about DHS and OHA and some opportunities there, finding folks that are on public assistance that we may be able to get onto federal VA benefits, working with the Department of Corrections to better serve incarcerated veterans, working with student veteran coordinators on campuses. When 90% of the state budget is in education, in public safety, in health and human services, a lot of our work can help drive savings on the rest of the budget. And we've been telling, in that engagement and awareness, telling the stories of our veterans and their families. And while a veteran is a veteran is a veteran, also trying to bring specific attention to underserved veterans populations, aging veterans being one of them, but we're also proud to have a women's veterans coordinator, an LGBTQ veterans coordinator, better access on rural veterans. So really looking at where are there some underserved veterans populations to engage, and then our own core operations.
Well, thank you. And I'll note for those in the audience that that if it seems like most of the committee members are staring at their computer screens rather than reading the overviews in the back of the room, it's because we can't read the overviews in the back of the room, and we're following along on our own screens up here. So please don't think we're reading the news headlines or checking Facebook.
So members of the committee, so here is our agency overview, and we always start with our Oregon veterans and citizens, obviously a direct report to the governor. In our advisory committee, nine members, veterans from across the state, always a challenge for us both to represent all eras of service, all of the branches, the geographic breadth, but we have an amazing advisory committee that helps connect us to the community from Ontario to Medford, to the Grand Ronde Tribe, to Portland and Mid-Willamette Valley. We have a great group of citizens helping engage us and connect us to the veterans community. Underneath for our team, now having an aging veteran services division for our two skilled nursing homes, the Oregon Veterans Home in the Dalles, built out in 1997, and the Oregon Veterans Home in Lebanon, our newest one that opened in 2014. And then also that conservatorship program that we talked briefly about, not just on the representative payee side, but the conservator works hand in hand with that veteran and their family across the whole range of their assets and income to make sure that they are taken care of for those that are financially vulnerable. Since 1945, we've had an Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs home loan program that falls under our financial services division, and one of our core programs that has built the capacity of our agency over time. Also, all of our accounting and financial services team and our facility services falls under this branch. And then that core meat and potatoes of statewide veteran services, here's going to be all of our pass-through to the county VSOs, our own operation in Portland co-located with the feds, our Salem working on both local for Marion and Polk, and we'll talk about transitioning Polk County veterans to their own county VSO office, and then that training and certification role that we have for all of the county VSOs working under our power of attorney to submit claims up to the federal VA, and then outreach at a statewide level. So our support services, communications, IT, the records unit, human resources and policy, they are complementary and hand-in-hand. Our communications team having to get that awareness out of these broad community benefits and federal VA benefits. Our policy team, given that we're a specific population but cross all number of policy areas, frequently asked by our other agencies and local partners for guidance in their specific areas like housing or healthcare and mental health. So about 88 total folks across the agency. So for our high-level budget overview, so here are just the operational expenditures that we have.
working hard over the years to build up that general fund capacity, but largely we are an other-funded agency historically. And that other fund has largely been driven, as Amanda mentioned, off of the home loan program and off of our nursing skilled nursing facilities. So the vast majority, so 120 million total funds, but 100 million of that is other funds off the home loan program and off of the skilled nursing. And you'll see, as Senator Boquist was mentioning, Senator Johnson as well, we've been ramping up that investment of general fund. Historically, about half of that general fund flows down to the county VSOs and the service organizations. And in this 17-19 for the governor's budget, total funds increase to about a little over $19 million. So going from $10 million to $19 million, but a significant chunk, and the new chunk of that, is coming off of the lottery funds for Measure 96. So that $19 million is a mix of $2 million general fund and a little over $17 million lottery funds. But as you can see from the pie chart, 70% of our budget is just to run those two skilled nursing facilities, about 14% on the home loan program at a little over $16 million. And veteran services at 16%.
Question,
please.
You may, Mr. Director, you may cover this earlier, but I was just curious when you see the veterans' homes. What's the occupancy? How? I know that's been some.
So, Co-Chair, Senator Hansel. So we're in a good spot right now, and it is one of our key performance measures we'll report on. But where skilled nursing typically is at 60-65%, we have a target goal of 80% and historically have always been over 90%. So with the new home for Lebanon, we reached essentially functional capacity at the fall of last year in 2016 and still have a few openings in the Dallas facility. Often the challenge in the Dallas is around staffing, both the recruitment and retention of staff, to allow the full occupancy there. But we are looking good in terms of census for both the facilities.
Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
Two things. One of them is, for the benefit of our new colleagues, if you would like to take an inspirational trip, go out to the Dells. It is the cleanest, prettiest, nicest facility and has one of the warmest feelings for an assisted living enterprise. Very robust memory care unit and certainly honors the veteran but also provides top-notch medical care, and it is in a beautiful location with a vista that looks across a magnificent gorge, and it's you'll be proud to be associated with the facility if you go out there. The other thing, Mr. Director, is I don't know if you've pursued any opportunities for internships or rotational opportunities with some of the nursing schools. I know that OHSU has had in the past a very active rural residency program where they're putting young doctors out in the field, and I didn't know whether or not there was any opportunity to get some nurses that are building resumes and skills rather than looking for, I mean, obviously they have to be supported in some way, but that might be an opportunity to get some, they get a benefit and you get a benefit by having them there.
So, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, we'd certainly be willing to explore staffing, as many of you know, for healthcare and skilled nursing, especially in rural areas, is a challenge. So whether it's military veterans trying to transition those skills and get credit into the nursing fields, whether it's linking to community colleges and the other nursing schools, or whether it's bringing some of that training on the job and in-house to ODVA and our veterans' homes, we'd love to explore that.
One other follow-up. Some of us had the honor of being members of Ways and Means when Ways and Means helped bail out some nursing students who were left marooned when their facility, their for-profit school, abruptly folded. And we helped provide a pathway for those nurses to finish their, student nurses, to finish their education to the point that they could sit the state exam. And I can't think of a better way to fully mature the state's investment in these nurses than to see about putting solicitations out for employment to them. That was all done through the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Ben Cannon and through PCC that provided the pathway for these nursing students to be able to complete their course requirements. Great recruitment opportunity, and if you snagged some of those nurses for any of your homes, it would certainly validate Ways and Means investment in saving their nursing careers.
Be great. Thank you. So the real, I mean, I just want to, one piece on the Veterans Home Loan. This is the program that has built ODVA's capacity over the year and over the years. And often we have significantly had to leverage home loan other funds to help fund for core services. So off of the leadership of the legislature, we've been able to shift over time core veteran service officers positions over, but still veteran services doesn't cover part of our agency costs, and much of that still has had to ride on the Veterans Home Loan Program, which is very different now than or today than it was over time, as we'll talk about later. So here again shows the breadth of the budget, and then always that specific on the lottery fund general fund that takes up much of the discussion. So where we have been about $10 million general fund, moving to about $19 million total across general fund lottery funds. And what I think we're proud of, out of that measure $96, never solely geared just to ODVA's own specific programs. We've always had that pass-through go to the counties at a significant level. We've always, and what's new here is those other partnerships. Senator Johnson mentioned the chipping away at. A lot of folks have their eyes on the lottery funds, but we also do want to drive some better partnerships to those that are serving student veterans, to those that are engaging on mental health and housing and homelessness. But again, it's it feels good to know that we are dividing that budget in a way that is fair, both to the counties, the service organizations, and the broader partnerships. But that central decision, both for the governor's budget and for the legislature, really is how much of those new lottery dollars are new, above and beyond, and supplemental to what the general fund has historically funded at ODVA, and how much of it is funding what we do today and not all supplemental work going forward. So for our core programs, Statewide Veteran Services is that advocate in the corner of the veterans and their families and that partnership with the counties. You can see that a gradual increase in general funds from the 07-09 legislatively adopted budget all the way through 15-17. And then that significant total funds increase to almost $20 million in this governor's budget for 17-19, and most of that made up with lottery funds. So in terms of some of our key performance measures, new power of attorney. We actually, our veteran service officers take on a limited power of attorney to represent that veteran's claim back to the federal VA. And it is a good way to show our breadth of outreach and connecting to veterans. So proud that we've increased that from a little over 8,000 to now almost 12,000 new power of attorneys in the calendar year 2016. An internal measure, most of, in terms of new claims, just in terms of the number of new claims that we submit, has doubled over the from fiscal year 13 to fiscal year 2016. And that is what increases that drawdown of the federal VA compensation and pension. And then to show what representation, having that advocate in your corner means, we are about that 15,000 average compensation is about $1,000 more than the national average. So having that advocate in your corner is significant to increase that compensation and return.
Mr. Director, it's not just the compensation and return. Just this morning, I have a veteran in my district whose taxes rose exponentially on an assessor's modeling, announcing that it is now a seller's market, ergo all of these older homes have increased value. His is a mobile home that ceased being mobile a long time ago. And so he's seeing a rise in property taxes that are unsustainable. I had talked to him about going with him to his hearing and am not able to do so because of legislative obligations, but we're relying on a local veterans group to send an advocate to go with him to help articulate his case, to keep him courageous in the face of the appeals board. And I think that one-on-one kind of assistance is absolutely pivotal. What I'm trying to figure out from this is I know the principals in my county, so I'm aware of the fact that they're doing this for all the right motivations. How are you able, if at all, to sort out the scammers? Because I think you've mentioned them a couple of times. I've certainly thought about them while you've been testifying. There are a lot of people that are happy to prey on veterans, and I wonder how you sort the wheat from the chaff in deciding who to entrust your veterans to.
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, I think relationships drive it significantly. So at a statewide level, our team doesn't necessarily have the eyes on to know who in Umatilla is upstanding from a nonprofit or who is blowing smoke to the veterans. There's a challenge to our system having that county and state role, but it is powerful to have that boots on the ground perspective of that county veteran service officer who is the eyes and ears in that community, boots on the ground, to know who those players are and where to make the links and where to make the referrals. To your point on heavily emphasizing that compensation, it is just one measure. It is hard to capture their work in terms of those broader community referrals and above and beyond work. It is significant beyond just that compensation, but hard to drive down a key performance measure on that.
Thank you.
So on our Veterans Home Loan Program, many of you are familiar with the federal VA loan, where essentially the federal VA is the loan guarantee and is able to offer, banks across the country are able to offer a zero down home loan product to veterans and their families. Since 1945, we have been the big bank of ODVA, where we sell tax advantage bonds. We are one of five states that are grandfathered into the IRS tax code. Many other states would like to get in there to be able to sell these tax advantage bonds and then offer below market rate interest loans to veterans and their families. At one time, if the loan market today is at about 4%, we're going to be in that low 3% to offer a veteran that loan. There are some restrictions that come off of that IRS tax code. This home loan has to be used for the qualified veterans mortgage bonds that are funding it. It has to be used within 25 years of the veterans leaving active duty and is not allowed for refinance of existing homes. At one time, we were the largest lender, not just in Oregon, but nationwide. And for some legislators, it was billions of dollars lent. And in the 80s, it was a little bit underwater. And to the credit of the leadership at the time, they saved the home loan program, both as a benefit to veterans, but also this has thrown off revenues that has funded the rest of the department over our 70-year history. But you can think of that World War II generation, 10% of able-bodied citizens in uniform, now less than 1% serving in uniform. The demographics of our veterans population has changed. The Great Recession has had a significant impact on that loan portfolio and loan program, but still a significant benefit, but one that can't quite fund the entirety of the agency sustainably long term. At one time had loan offices across the state and 600 ODVA employees statewide, now relying on that network of brokers and bankers where we originate the loans, but also retain that servicing for the lifetime of the loan to the veteran. We're able to do some cost savings after the Great Recession, and now approximately $16.7 million on the other fund program for home loans. So one of our major KPMs for the home loan program is to make sure that we minimize delinquent accounts, and this is a 90 days delinquent or more. Literally, you can count on your hand the number of foreclosures that our program has. We did have a significant spike out of 2008, 2009, and even into 2012, but our goal of having less than 1.5% in a delinquent status And it's one of the benefits of this program. It is not our goal to kick the veteran and their family out of their home. Often it's going to make a quick call to yourselves and our other elected leaders. And it is our mission to make sure they've got a roof over their heads, and we can create that flexibility when they do run into challenges. In terms of originations, it went down significantly in that 2009 era, but now ramping back up 50 million plus in 2014, and now up to $62 million in originations with a much smaller team after some of the reductions after the Great Recession. Any questions on our home loan program?
Question.
Please, Senator.
I'm not familiar with originations. What is meant by that term?
So, Co-Chair Senator Hansel, when we are making that loan, so generating a new loan would be the originations side of it, and then the servicing portfolio side, once we have made that loan, working with the borrower throughout the loan.
And how many did, follow up, how many did you say originations did you have?
Co-Chair Senator Hansel, in terms of a dollar value, $62 million in originations in new loans out to veterans in the last, in 2016.
Do you know how many loans that would represent?
I'd have to call on my lifelines to see if they could get the 2016 number on number of loans. In terms of a total portfolio now, a little under 2,000 loans total for the portfolio. Now upwards of about $270 million across the portfolio. So that where we were hundreds of thousands of loans in the past, now about 2,000 loans on the books. And we'll get that number for
that's close
calendar year.
So, Director, when I look at the various reports on delinquent debt across the state, and when I look at that for your department, would most of the delinquent debt that you're carrying be coming out of the home loan program?
Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, there'd be a small slice, I think, in terms of the skilled nursing as well. But the vast amount of that, we also, you know, foreclosure doesn't always result in the loss, depending on the value of that home. And we make every opportunity to try to recover that. It's balancing that what is in the interest of the individual veteran that may be challenged not making those payments versus the total financial health so that we can continue to serve all veterans.
I understand that. But let me delve a little deeper. The reports are not yet out for 2016, but I was looking at 2014 and 15, and I'm seeing in 2014 you were carrying about $2.4 million in delinquent debt. That went up to $2.9 in 2015, so about $500,000 more. Do you think that trend is continuing in the most recent year? Or?
Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, I think it's on a decreasing trend, but we'll double-check on the numbers and see if we can present a slide on that tomorrow as well.
All right. I'd like to talk about it a little bit more, but the final question I've got on this topic is, if delinquent debt increases in this account, how does that affect your ability to provide opportunities to other applicants?
And Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, it is that balancing act, making sure that it doesn't become an impact to the overall portfolio, to make sure that that financial health of that still allows us to sell those tax advantage bonds for that future generation.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit more about that later. Please continue.
Thank you. Now on to the two skilled nursing facilities. So again, the facility that was built out in 1997 in the Dalles and our newest one in Lebanon, they are truly the place where honor lives, both for those veterans and spouses who are there, but also the incredible team that we have in place with the Veterans Care Centers of Oregon and our professional contract management team. It's that partnership across ODVA, VCCO, and the community that make these veterans' homes incredible. Grew out of that old soldiers' home model of the Civil War on the East Coast and in the Midwest, but now world-class 24-hour skilled nursing care, both in terms of how we have built these facilities, leveraging federal VA construction dollars to 65%, locally with a 35% grant, and then with a federal VA per diem that goes a long way in addition to the other revenue streams of Medicaid, Medicare, and private pay as well. So obviously, and these are
you know, healthcare is no small potato. So even with one facility, it was in the $20 million range on a biennial basis. And as we have ramped up with that second facility in the Dalles, a significant spike in this current biennium, and that now with full census or largely full census at both facilities, now upwards of over $80 million of other fund to fund those on a biennial basis. So one of the, in addition to the excellent care that is provided, one of the benefits to veterans and their families is a significant below market rate and have that lower cost to the residents. A significant chunk of that comes from that federal VA per diem, but also the outstanding work of our team and the contractors. So now about $205 on a daily basis cost, significantly lower than the $286 on a statewide average for other skilled nursing facilities. A little bit lower cost in the Dalles compared to what we're able to offer in the Lebanon, but collectively $205 a day. High average occupancy makes these two veterans homes pencil and make sure that we are able to deliver, make sure they are financially healthy and able to deliver on that mission to care for our veterans and their families. Had to build up significant reserves off of the veterans home in the Dalles. A little bit of general fund went into the debt service from the state as design changed to the Lebanon veterans home to about $4 million of general funded bonding, but we're able to build out that second home all on other funds and with matching it to our other funds generated out of the Dalles. Our census took a significant hit as we ramped up those startup operations, opened in the fall of 2014, and took two full years to come to census, both to ramp up the staff and to admit those residents. Again, Senator Hansel's question, now above that 90% mark for both the facilities in the Dalles and Lebanon. Any questions on the veterans' homes? Great.
No, thank you.
So for some of the major budget drivers that we've talked about here today, overall, there has been a significant increase in the filing of claims. And I attribute this both to those younger, I mean, we've been at war for over 15 years, still deploying folks overseas. Just a couple weeks ago, another 90 Oregon National Guardsmen headed to the Middle East. And while more and more of those current service members returning are surviving the battlefield, they are often coming back with complex injuries. As they get quickly from the Middle East back to Germany, they are able to survive, but significant injuries that they are facing, multiple injuries as they come back. But not just those younger veterans, but also those aging veterans who may not have engaged in services when they came home, but also have unique needs as they age. That demographics is driving who is coming to that veteran services and to our partner serving veterans. As we talked a little bit, sustainable funding, we've had a long history of using veteran home loan dollars into the veteran services and to pay for core services across the agency. Gets harder to do sustainably on an ongoing basis. We have been incurring losses on the home loan reserves, about $2 million a year, even after swapping over the veteran service officers. So looking to how do we cover some of those core costs going forward will be a significant challenge and opportunity. And then Measure 96, House Joint Resolution 202 is that unanimous and bipartisan resolution, having Measure 96 go to the ballot in November, with 84% of Oregonians stepping up to say they want to better serve Oregon veterans and their families. This is what dedicates 1.5% of net lottery proceeds into the Constitution, raises about $18.5 million on the lottery funds to better serve veterans, not just at ODVA, but wherever veterans can be better served. So here are our
what is a very difficult budget, where many agencies are having a hard time just keeping up with current service level. We have an opportunity to consider new policy option packages to better serve veterans given that new revenue out of Measure 96. And while our strategic framework at a high level frames out where we want to go for our policy option packages, ultimately we want to identify and connect more veterans and their families to benefits and resources, increase that drawdown of significant federal funds, better leverage partnerships to expand service delivery, not just at ODVA, but with our partners, to reduce demand on state resources, and then to align sustainable funding for core services for the long term. So our first policy option package is around our information services, both for our conservatorship program and our home loan program. We are on IBM, iSeries, COBOL, green screens that have served us very well over the last 20, 30 years. And would serve us well going forward if we were able to have the maintainers and the knowledge of that code base going forward. But you simply cannot hire COBOL programmers. And currently we are contracted back on a retiree development. Co-Chair Johnson signaling, maybe Senator Monroe with his wisdom will be in the market. But we are contracted back with one of our the original developer of our two systems, 2 days a week, contracted back one of the ODVA retirees to make sure that we're able to maintain these systems. But when you're looking at the $30 million in assets that are under the conservatorship, when you're looking at the $270 million loan portfolio, if she wins the lottery or decides she doesn't want to contract back anymore, we're in a world of hurt pretty quickly, and back to stubby pencils to run these programs. So we are looking, and for the conservatorship side, it is not as much of an industry. There are private providers out there, but there are not as many technology solutions for conservatorship providers. We have looked for more off-the-shelf opportunities, but now looks like this would be an RFP to modernize that outdated COBOL language into a modern coding language to make sure that we're able to serve those conservator clients. Whether it's reports and accounting for our own internal finances in the legislature, whether it's out to the veterans or also the courts that ultimately appoint us and hold us accountable for those funds. On the home loan side, it's a much
yes, sir. Please, excuse me for interrupting. Senator Johnson.
Mr. Director, on your IT projects that you're looking at, have you started the Kabuki Theater that is the stage gate process?
Correct. Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee. So these two projects combined would be less than $1 million and not formally, I think, have to be part of the stage gate process. But given these are significant projects to an agency of our size and significant programs, it will be somewhat of a hybrid nature, but working closely both with the CIO's office and the Strategic Technology Office to today tee up those mapping of what we have today, do those business case analysis. It's essentially a hybrid stage gate process for these projects.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Have you reached out to any states that might be considered best in class to see if you could just steal their processes?
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, specifically
honorably purloin.
Specifically on conservatorship. There's a handful of states that do offer conservatorship, and while we've reached out to them, it doesn't look like it's something that will be the best fit for ours. On the home loan side, it is more of an industry where you can have a more of a technology package and software as a service, both on that originations and servicing. So today we are mapping all of that underlying code to make sure we know what we have today to then be able to translate it into current software. And I think it is going to pay dividends not just to these two programs, but longer term to make sure even at a small agency like ODVA that our programs aren't siloed. And ultimately trying to drive better collection of data on our veterans and better leveraging that data, both for our business programs and linking to broader partnerships to make sure that we continue to better serve veterans. On the home loan side, today we are separate for the originations and servicing. It's inefficient, a lot of duplicate entry, which leads to more errors. Ultimately, it's going to be more effective and efficient, both for our team, but also veterans forward-facing to the veterans that we're serving. So the largest policy option package, POP 102, this is that core veteran services. So we were able to leverage $1.5 million. So the kind of broken into three areas, down to the veteran service officers, both with the county and service organizations, investments to better serve aging veterans, and then also funding alignment that we were talking about. So with Target Veteran Services, where CVSO pass-through was about $4.7 million in this biennium. Some of that was one-time money, $500,000, but able to buy that back in this policy option package with $1.5 million to get county VSOs up to $5.8 million. And that those resources at that level, we don't believe triggers any additional training or any additional investments at ODVA from a statewide investment. Where earlier in our agency request, more significant investments into the county VSOs, we would want to make sure that we have the training capacity and the claims review capacity and make sure that we don't become the bottleneck. But at $1.5 million, it would still be a significant surge down to the county level.
Senator Johnson.
In your read of the ballot measure, would any of those funds be appropriately applied to these policy option packages?
So Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, when we submitted our agency request budget, it was back in August 1st.
Right.
So all of our, you know, we went forward with the assumption of lottery dollars coming online. All of our agency request budget POPs, which all made it into the governor's budget, but at different levels, we requested general fund. They morphed into lottery funds for the governor's budget that was released December 1 after the general election. It was always, I mean, from the policy committees, from the legislature, there was always a broad intent. How Measure 96 was written is so broadly defined that almost anything that we want to do to better serve veterans is possible.
Colleagues, on that note, I mean, general fund is going to be in unbelievably short supply. And if the ballot measure is sufficiently broad and that money is available from the lottery, I would certainly hope that we would have the opportunity to consider that fund substitution to be something commensurate with the opinion of Oregonians who passed that ballot measure with the idea of serving the veteran. If we can serve the veteran through better management of the home loan program or better management of the transfer of benefits or any of the other things that you've enumerated in your POPs, that would certainly strike me as a reasonable place to look for money and leave some of that precious general fund for other budgets that are going to go begging.
And Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, that is the central question before this committee and the legislature. Off of a very vocal veterans community, we were down to about $2 million general fund in the governor's proposed budget. It appears, if we're reading the tea leaves of the framework correctly, they added some more general fund back to about $5 million. Whatever that number is, I think our emphasis is that there is a mix of general fund and lottery fund so that we don't solely become at the mercy of the lottery fund long term for our veterans' efforts.
I don't dispute that, Mr. Director, but there is no timeline on the ballot measure, correct?
Correct. So, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, it sets it aside 1.5% of those net lottery revenues into a veteran services fund. Even the governor's budget did not, it's projected to be $18.5 million. We want some set aside as reserves just for any ups and downs, just like parks and some of the other lottery funded agencies have done. It ultimately does have to serve veterans is the mandate, but not a timeline and no requirement on general fund.
Well, I could see heads nodding behind you. I assume in opposition to the direction that I'm heading. But the point of the story here is that the ballot measure said help veterans, and I think none of us dispute that. The question is, we are at a deplorable place in this state where we are pitting one interest group against another. And I would just hope that the veterans community would stay sufficiently open-minded that if the benefit of those lottery dollars is for veterans, that its deployment might give us, let us use maximum flexibility in what is arguably a very difficult budget cycle so that while veterans now may feel, you know, well taken care of, or even the beginning of adequately taken care of by the passage of the ballot measure, there are going to be others that are going to get thrown out of programs. And I would just suggest that to the degree that we can all keep open minds about how this money is used, if it's for the benefit of veterans, that we not get too prescriptive in how we describe its application. It would be very helpful from you to be able to have some sense of what you're hearing from the veteran community. Whether it's just, it's ours and we get to keep it and we get to spend it any way we want, or whether there is a recognition that this is an ongoing funding source that others do not have, and a sense of sort of shared sacrifices or Oregonians as long as any of that money is used for the benefit of veterans.
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, I think we'll have a lot of public testimony tomorrow. I think there's still a gut sense that this was, from the veterans community, that this was going to be above and beyond dedication, not just a replacement. From a rational perspective, this is a total funds increase, but what the veterans community still hears is that significant cut on the general fund side. Wherever that number lands, I think there will be a healthy mix ultimately across general fund, lottery fund, from the initial signals that we've seen. We are in the fortunate position as an agency and to our partners serving veterans. This is a total funds increased budget, which is not what every other agency is simply trying to get back to current service to do what they do today, much less transform where they need to go,
right,
across state police, health and human services, education.
And to the angry stares just over your shoulder, I want to...
They may relieve me from my duties as director.
I want to assure you that all of us respect the fact that this money is for veterans. I think that there is clearly an argument that says, give us what you gave us, and now give us what the ballot measure gave us in addition. Some of us at this dais are going to be faced with the question of who do we not take care of? And
what makes me feel like a strong advocate, both for, you know, that rational case or a total new supplemental case, is it doesn't solely have to go to ODVA programs. And as we get into some of the other partnerships, if we want to ramp up some of the housing efforts, if we want to ramp up student veterans and get this money to community colleges and universities, I don't imagine they want a 180% increase for our budget to stay at ODVA if that's a full supplemental resource of lottery. But it could go a long way to augment other program areas, but serving that same population of veterans.
And I would agree with you. We were just at PCC when Ways and Means was on the road and heard very compelling testimony. We were within a stone's throw of
Correct.
The student veterans office. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm just making the case that there is the very real possibility that the co-chair's framework may be closer to the actual budget that we have than some of the more aspirational thoughts if we get boatloads of new revenue. The distance between us and new revenue is a pretty wide gap right now, and we will be guided and helped, I'm sure, by your input and through you, the input of the veterans community in helping to work our way through this. We're still way early in the session, but we're in some pretty tough times.
Indeed. Representative Dearman, you had a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So, Mr. Smith, I appreciate you. You do a really good job of being neutral and being diplomatic and all that. But the message that I get from the voters was, to quote Senator Johnson, of we get what we used to get, plus we get the lottery. That was the message that I get from the voters. And I get it that there's other realities on the table, too. But I think that kind of needs to be the starting point, is that that the voters of the state of Oregon wanted to add to services to veterans. And so I'm doing my darndest to make that happen. So.
And Representative Reardon.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Two questions, if I may. But one is on your computer pop. Is that an effort that you're working on with other agencies so that you can share data better, say, with DHS or and so forth?
co-chairs, Representative Reardon, bringing it into that 21st century for coding language will be able to allow better data sharing about how veterans are being served at DHS, OHA, and other partners to be able to commingle that data to get some results.
Okay. It seems to be a common thread. And my second question, if I may.
Please.
So back in the day when I was on a school board, we ran into the same issue where sometimes there'd be a really long list of needs and a shorter list for money. So we draw a line on there. So do you do something like that? Say, you know, say the housing program, for example. You know, is there a greater demand than what you can fund at this time? Or I just like to understand, with a lot of money, how close are we to meeting all the needs?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, it feels a little bit like a loaded question. I mean, for our prioritization of our POPs, we begin kind of with the must-haves that we need to do for today, for the things that we are already responsible for. And while $18 million of those new lottery dollars in our agency request and the 19 total funds, it's a lot of resources for veterans, but it goes very quickly when you begin. Especially, so we've had to try to leverage and prioritize how to get those resources to those that already have programs in place so that we aren't slicing off new staff and administration. You'll see across this only 4 new FTE out of all of these new proposals so that we better leverage Oregon Housing and Community Services, that we leverage the community colleges to try to get what are limited dollars as much as possible to the boots on the ground level serving veterans.
Can I try again?
Okay, what? Please. Right.
So, but there's no list. It's just sort of an ongoing battle.
So, co-chairs, Representative Reardon, any additional resources are going to be highly leveraged. I mean, we are going to draw down those federal VA resources.
Yeah.
And eventually, we'll reach a breaking point where we've maxed out that outreach to veterans. But we still have 1,500 homeless veterans across the state. We still have a quarter. It's hard because these outcomes, I don't know that they are fundamentally driven by dollars as much as true leadership and collaboration across diverse partners. So it's hard. I mean, we put $160+ billion of federal VA resources nationwide and still have these challenges. I think ultimately it is less a question of dollars as much as what are we doing with it and are we truly collaborating across diverse partners. I would put more of the weight on that than what dollar amount is the right one.
So, Director Smith, I know you've got 3 more POPs to go, and I think that we're actually ahead of schedule in terms of your presentation. We're getting into a provocative conversation here, an appropriate conversation, and I hope that that those people who have strong feelings that that we should indeed be looking at what this department got before, plus what the ballot measure put forward. I hope those people will tune in when this very committee gets to sit down with some of the people who are hoping that that they might have received funding and would see that funding diminished. That's going to be a provocative conversation as well. But let's do this. So let's hold this until tomorrow. Same time, same station, and we'll finish up with your POPs. We'll take more questions. We'll hear from Ms. Brickman, and we'll hear from a lot of people in the audience that will have comments to share with us. So I hope that everybody will be back. Is there anything before I close this public hearing? All right, I will do that, and I will go ahead and adjourn us until we reconvene tomorrow afternoon. Thank you, everyone. Cool.